the Buddha described his early practice with an interesting statement. He said, "With my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained, and crushed mind with mind. While I did so, sweat ran from my armpits. Just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head and shoulders and beat him down, constrain him, and crush him, so too, with my teeth clenched and my tongue pressed against the roof of my mouth, I beat down, constrained, and crushed mind with mind, and sweat ran from my armpits. But although tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness was established, my body was overwrought and uncalm because I was exhausted by the painful striving." Quite a strong statement of effort. But the Buddha realized that although his effort was intense and was rather extreme, it wasn't actually bringing him the result that he wished, the freedom that he sought for. And he had a thought. He wondered, could there be another path to enlightenment? Could there be another way? And he remembered a time when he was a young boy, and his father was working in the was working. They were having a kind of a plowing festival, a plowing ceremony, and young Siddhartha was waiting under the shade of a tree nearby. And as he was sitting there, comfortable, quiet, secluded, and in the shade, he experienced a deep state of quietness, of calm, of clarity. And he wondered, could this be a way to practice, to realize awakening? Now, I think we're very fortunate that the Buddha had this realization that painful, intense striving was not the path to freedom. And he discovered a way that leads to the middle path, the middle way, that is not of extreme striving and yet is not of laziness either. We have to respect the Buddha's rigor. He wasn't lazy. He wasn't slothful. You may know the story of the Buddha's history, the Buddha's young and early years when he was, before his enlightenment, when he was striving. He did very strong austerity practices, and his effort was intense. He would fast to the extreme of what the body could take, and he would do various kinds of severe ascetic practices. He had the courage, he had the willingness to apply himself wholeheartedly and completely to the path, and the willingness to confront very painful circumstances. There's tremendous beauty in this kind of effort, this kind of courage, this kind of putting forth of oneself in the practice. But if we're always striving, if we're forcing ourselves without knowing rest, then we're going to find ourselves frustrated, exhausted, fatigued. We won't be strengthened by the practice. We have to find a way to balance effort and non-effort, a way to find ease in a fullness of commitment. In my own practice, I've had to balance some teachings that I've received that have been a very strong effort with teachings of profound relaxation. In the past 6 or so years, about the last 6.5 years, I've been practicing with a Burmese master named Venerable Pao Ok Sayadaw. And he teaches a very systematic, methodical, and effortful approach to meditation. It's a very demanding practice. And I find tremendous beauty and power in putting forth every ounce of energy that I have access to, putting it into the practice, day and night. But I've also practiced with other teachers who have a much more relaxed teaching. For example, Nyoshal Ken Rinpoche said, "Rest in natural great peace, this exhausted mind, beaten helpless by karma and neurotic thought, like the relentless fury of the pounding waves in the infinite ocean of samsara." It's a very different approach to simply be in touch with our weariness. Are we in touch with that tiredness that comes from following after the restless mind that thinks about this and worries about that and frets about this and wants that? Pushed and pulled between the things that we like and the things that we don't like. Circling around compulsive thoughts and habits. Do we sense the tiredness of this, the become fed up with it, want to let it go? Let the fantasy go. Let the reactivity go. Let the worry, the regret, the anxiety fall away. Are we willing to release them and abide in deep relaxation? Often we fill up our quiet time busying our minds, busying ourselves, fabricating stories about what we have done and what we must do. Sometimes we almost narrate our experience to ourselves, commenting on what we're experiencing now, creating a story of ourselves, even in the meditation, a story of ourselves as the meditator. Can we let go of our stories and simply be a friend to ourselves, a true friend, and in an intimate relationship with our sensory experience, intimately experiencing the lifting of the foot off the floor, the moving of the foot forward, and the placing it down, to be totally, wholeheartedly present for the sitting posture, for a sound, for a breath? If we're living in a world of stories, of fantasies, not fully awake to where we are, we're probably separating ourselves from the vividness of simply sitting and being. We can use concepts to separate ourselves from the vitality of the present moment. We can look and see for ourselves, do our concepts really bring us closer to a lived, vital experience? Or do they in some way separate us just a little bit from the vividness of present moment life? When we don't use our energy for release, for awakening, we might find that we are using our mental energies to entertain ourselves, to keep ourselves busy, to be involved in self-absorbed proliferations of thought. This busyness of mind can prevent us from feeling that fatigue, that tiredness that comes when we recognize how restless the mind is, until we recognize how painful restlessness is, we will never let it go. We must desire that profound rest that comes with the stillness of heart, a quietness of mind, a profoundness of presence. When I lived in India with a guru named H.W.L. Punja, he often told a story of an airplane, and he would say to me, he would say, "You've boarded the airplane. Why do you keep getting up, getting out, and trying to push it? Sit down, buckle your seatbelt, and enjoy the view." Sometimes we make effort, pushing, pushing, pushing ourselves, when what's really needed is the willingness to sit down, buckle our seatbelt, and watch the show go by. Listen to the sounds, listen, feel the sensations. Observe thoughts arising and passing, just floating by like clouds. Sometimes when we work with the posture, we can get clues as to how much effort is really needed and what might be excess effort. How much effort does it take to sit in an aligned and comfortable posture? When we do postural work, sometimes people try to overdo, you know, stand up straight like a military posture, or try to keep fixing and adjusting and fussing with the posture, trying to get it just right and then hold it there. But a mindful approach to posture, mindfulness of the sitting posture, mindfulness of the standing posture, the reclining posture, or the walking postures, invites more of a fluid reflection, a release into the experience that the body is taking then, so that we release and rest in an alignment with gravity that is freeing, that is light, that is a wise response to our relationship to gravity. When we tune in to the parts of the body that are heavy and light, when we connect with the support and the contact with the floor and the seat, we're providing a foundation for the body itself to be at ease, to be at rest, to be in a state of release as we respond to gravity. Sometimes when people have heard that I practiced with, lived with, and stayed with Punjaji for some years, they assume that that means that I don't meditate, because Punjaji had a reputation, one could say, for not recommending meditation. Now, to some extent, it's true that he didn't teach meditation, but I think this is really misunderstood. He didn't teach any technical form of meditation. This is true. He didn't teach us to sit in a particular way, to follow the breath. No, he didn't teach any kind of body scan or any kind of systematic approach to applying attention to the body or the mind. And yet, I lived with him. I know what he did. He would wake up sometime between 4 and 4:30 each morning, and he would sit on the edge of his bed, cross both legs, put both hands on his knees, and close his eyes. But he wasn't meditating. And he'd sit like that until about 5 o'clock, and then he'd get up and do some bath, take his bath and things. And then he'd sit back on his bed cross both legs, put both hands on his knees, close his eyes, and not meditate. And then when we would go for a walk, get the milk, and then I would go into the kitchen and prepare the breakfast, and he would sit on the edge of the bed, cross both legs, put both hands on his knees, close his eyes, and not meditate. And this would go on throughout the day. Whenever there was a few moments between activities, he would sit down, cross both legs, put his hands on his leg, close his eyes. And I assume he was not meditating. I don't know what he was doing, actually. I never asked him what he was doing. But since he didn't teach meditation, I assumed he was practicing not meditating. So I calculated that each day there were a minimum of 4 hours, more often six, that he spent sitting cross-legged, hands on the knees, eyes closed, not meditating. So when people say that they follow his teachings and don't meditate, if they do it that way, I say yes. Great. But most of the time people hear not meditating and then they think the lazy mind takes over and they think, I don't have to do anything. I'm just going to kick back and go with the flow of my tendencies. If I want this, I'm going to go get it. If I don't like this, I'm going to move away from it. But that isn't what he did. What does it mean to not meditate? He never told me to not meditate. Never, not once. I lived under his roof for more than 3 years over a 6-year period. Never once did he tell me not to meditate. He told me to meditate constantly, day and night, in the kitchen, in the satsang hall, in the bazaar, all day, all night, waking, sleeping, dreaming, to meditate constantly. Maybe that's not meditation too. What does meditation mean? What do we think we're doing to be meditating? Were you meditating during the supper time tonight? You weren't sitting with your legs crossed, your eyes weren't closed. Were you meditating? What is required to call something meditation? It certainly isn't the posture, because clearly the Buddha taught various postures. And you don't doubt that the walking meditation that we did was meditation, right? Or the reclining posture or the standing posture. They felt rather meditative, didn't they, when we did the four postures today? So it certainly isn't the arrangement of the legs. What does it mean to meditate? The Buddhist teachings not only describe the four postures for meditation, but they also describe practicing clear comprehension while we are turning our heads, while we are looking straight and looking behind, while we are bending and lifting and reaching, while we're swallowing, while we're licking, while we're urinating and defecating, while we're speaking and keeping silent. All of these activities are included in the field of wakefulness, of mindfulness, of clear comprehension. Could this too be meditation? There are so many approaches to meditation that it's clear that there is no single right way. In contrast, another teaching on this is from Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche, who said, leave everything as it is in fundamental simplicity, and clarity will arise by itself. Only by doing nothing will you do all there is to be done. What a profound meditation teaching. But it is a little bit different in style than the instruction that I got when I lived in Thailand. When I lived in Thailand, I stayed in monasteries for a number of years. And there the practice was rigorous. And the practice wasn't so much long hours of sitting in silence. Instead, the practice was watching the mind in all activities, and to work directly with obstacles, with difficulties, with pain or discomfort, to take on different practices, like, just sleeping on the floor in the jungle, on the ground, you know, no bed, no mattress, no plank, nothing, just right in the dirt, and working with any discomfort that might come, to work with limitations in the monastic life on the meals, of how to eat just one meal a day, or to eat just not to take what one wants, but just take one spoon from each dish, or to just do all kinds of various things that keep the food just enough to nourish the body. We would walk barefoot for days at a time, doing tudong practice in the jungle, walking from village to village. These kinds of practices asked us to work with discomfort in the body, but this wasn't really a challenging practice. At that time, I was young. So, when you're young, it's a lot easier. What was really hard, though, and what I had to practice with, was not having control over my social environment. I had no privacy for years. I'd have to sleep in the same room in the meditation hall with 100 other women. Coming from the United States, where I had my own room, this was a challenge. To live in another culture, that was a challenge. To not have people that understood my culture, my ways of talking, my ways of being, my cultural values. That was challenging. That was difficult. And those of you who have traveled know that there are times when it's so freeing to actually be outside of our culture, but there are other times when it's such a relief to just meet somebody else who comes from the same place, and you can sit down and have a conversation and feel like you understand each other. And there's something that's like, ah. So I worked during those years in the monastic life with the physical austerities, but also the social one. All of these practices involve equanimity and patience. We're renouncing convenience and comfort. We're renouncing control. We're willing to practice to be awake with whatever is. So this monastic practice had one form of kind of rigor to it. But I practiced with a different teacher in the United States, actually, who was working with a different system of meditation, and it was a technical form of meditation. And this teacher asked me to report how many hours and how many minutes I spent each day sitting in formal meditation or walking in formal meditation. And so I kept in my pocket a little schedule, and I would mark down my accomplishment after each time and add it up before my interview and report how much time I spent meditating. Now, it was a little obsessive, and please don't do it. You don't need to, and you don't need to come and report how many minutes you are meditating. I would even have to subtract the minutes, like if I sneezed or blew my nose or went to the bathroom. Oh, can't count that minute. But what it did do is it developed a continuity of mindfulness and attention really very strongly throughout the day. So I didn't fill in those gaps between the sitting and the walking because I had to report. So I wanted to go do my walking very quickly. I didn't like go wander about a little bit and then find my way with a cup of tea to my walking place and stroll along a little bit and then, you know, meander back. It was pretty crisp. And there's something to be said for having a crispness to the beginning and endings, a clarity to our practice, so that we know when we're putting forth the effort that we're putting forth our effort fully. As I was doing this practice with this teacher, it was some years ago when I was having to report how long I was practicing, it was so hard for me to meet the target goal. It was more hours than I thought I would ever be able to meditate. And I had a discovery at one point because I kept being so tired, so exhausted. I was putting in every shred of effort and energy I possibly could and just being exhausted and not ever quite being able to meet the number of hours that I had been asked to do. And so, but at one point, I kind of gave up. But it was the giving up not of resignation. It was the giving up of resistance. I just started to do it. Full effort, because there was no more resistance. Just complete, full effort. Not trying to do it, but actually just doing it. And suddenly it became easy. It became easy to do more than the hours than I was requested because I found what 100% effort was. It wasn't trying harder. I was trying hard before. It was not resisting. It was sensing what effort and energy was available to me and using it fully when it was present. And when it was gone, I would rest and restore that energy and use it fully again. So it was more a matter of tuning in and loving the capacity to practice, loving it so fully that I wasn't trying to hold back and protect myself from practice. Fear that if I gave myself fully, then I would be tired later. Nah, just ease, the ease of complete commitment, fully. And then when I would rest fully. And then I would wake up some hours later and practice fully. And when the energy was gone, rest again. What is 100% effort for you? We're each going to have to find that out, and it's going to be different every day. But I guarantee that the drag is going to be the resistance. It's going to be the place where we're trying to protect ourselves from our engagement with life. Well, after some years of doing this kind of rather rigorous practice, another teacher gave me a challenge. And he said, "Don't practice mindfulness." I was horrified. In fact, I was angry. "What do you mean not practice mindfulness? What do you think I'm doing here? I'm on this retreat. I'm practicing mindfulness. And I'm doing it very diligently." I said, "Don't practice mindfulness." And I left the interview refusing to not practice mindfulness. But I had already experienced the anger in the refusal. And so there I was doing my walking meditation, realizing, there's anger here. Got to work with this. Maybe I'll try the instruction. Just see. And so the instruction had been to follow the schedule, sitting when there's sitting to sit, when there's walking to walk. Sit and walk, just follow the schedule, but don't practice mindfulness. It was quite a revelation to me to realize how much extra I was doing to practice mindfulness, because when I simply sat and walked
How can you make the mindfulness not occur? I refuse to be aware. I'm just going to walk, and I'm not going to be aware. It's absurd. It helped point to the naturalness of awareness, and revealed the way in which I might have been attached to a particular way of applying the effort in order to become mindful, which is different than being awake as I walked and being awake as I sat, where natural mindfulness pervaded the experience. When I practiced with Nyoshul Ken Rinpoche, he gave me a simple instruction. And he kept repeating the same instruction. I never got any fancy instruction. I always got two words and a lot of blessings. He bopped books on my head all the time. And then he would give me the same two-word instruction. And then the next day he would bop a book on my head and give me the same two-word instruction. He'd say, just relax. And when he said just relax, he would throw his arms and his head back and he would open his mouth and go, ah. Just relax. Now try this. Open your arms. Completely let go. Completely let go. Now, he was another one who taught non-meditation, said just relax. But every time I went into his room to get bopped on the head and told to relax, guess what he was doing? He was either sitting in silence, or he was chanting with his mala, or he was chanting his Tibetan books. Never once did I see him prop his feet up and drink a Mai Tai or something. No, continuously, day and night, early morning, late at night, midday, all day long, chanting, studying, sitting, but just relax. So when we hear these instructions to just relax, it doesn't mean to just go to the beach and hang out. Milarepa said, return to your natural state without effort or distraction. Know the way of such relaxation, fortunate ones. So what does it mean to meditate without doing the meditation? It doesn't mean that we should let the mind wander into habitual tendencies. We know how we waste time. We know when our minds are lost in wasteful habits, conditioned patterns. Sometimes something needs to be done. If you're tired and you want to rest, and your bed is on the second floor, you have to make the effort. You have to walk up those stairs in order to get in bed. We're not like children that can just say, Daddy, Daddy, would you carry me? No, we have to walk up those stairs ourselves. We have to discover the way to rest. So on the one hand, there's non-effort, and on the other hand, there is effort, non-doing and doing. But we must know what it is we are doing. What are we directing our effort toward? We might be trying to overcome obstacles. Maybe there's sleepiness or restlessness, dullness, anger, fear, anxiety, self-judgment. Maybe we're recognizing these and learning to let them go. It's natural to encounter hindrances in our practice. Obstacles come, especially the first day. The first few days. Okay, the first few decades, I admit it. That's why we meditate. You didn't really come here because you thought this would be an easy way to spend 10 days. No, we're willing to face the obstacles. We're willing to sit here in the quiet and realize that we want to. We have the ability and the courage to look and see what are the obstacles within our own minds and face them and unravel them. So sometimes our effort is directed towards facing these difficulties, these hindrances. And sometimes our effort is directed towards investigating what is really happening. Okay, there's a thought, but what is this thought about? Not the content of the thought. Who cares what the story is? That story can change. It goes from one story to the next. If you start to follow a train of thought, wherever you started, you're going to end up someplace else. You might hear the sound of a bird, twitter, 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 and then you start thinking about this particular kind of bird, and it laid a particular egg, and then you start thinking about egg salad, and why don't they make egg salad? And then you start thinking, maybe I should get on staff on some retreat so that I can make egg salad. And then you start thinking about what the experience of staff would be like, and you start thinking about the service component, and you get all inspired, and then you start thinking about relationships, and then you start thinking, oh, there's such beautiful relationships and staff. But sometimes relationships are difficult, and then you start thinking about your own relationships. And then you think, oh, I'm having such a big problem in this relationship and that relationship, and then na 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 na, and then, well, it was just the sound of a bird. That's what the mind does. So in meditation, we're not interested in the content really at all. Oh, you want to say for a minute? Thank you. Yeah. When there's keywords, it's helpful. We're not interested in tohen. Tohen. Yes, we're not interested in that. It's just a story. It's just a fabrication. It's a fiction. But it's really helpful to see our relationship to thought. What does thought serve? Why does the mind and body keep putting effort and energy into thinking? What is this doing for us? What is it constructing within us? So we can sometimes use our effort and our energy to look into the mind, to investigate phenomena. And in insight meditation practice, the primary thing we see when we investigate, I'll just tell you what it is, because we can look at anything and find this. It's that it changes. If you want to know how to investigate thought, see it change. If you want to know how to investigate the body, see its impermanence, see it change. If you want to know how to investigate a mood or emotion, see it change. You don't have to trace its causes back to your childhood. All you have to do is see it change. Because when we watch something changing, we see one of its universal characteristics. And we don't grasp things that are changing. How can we grasp something that's changing? You see a river floating by, and you say, stop, 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 I'm going to put my hand there and make it stop. No. We see it flowing by. When we see our experience flowing by, we don't grasp it. We simply observe it. We know it fully. We live it, but without the grasping. Sometimes our effort is more subtle. It's just a matter of aligning ourselves, maybe tuning ourselves to the unconditioned, to the deathless, to something very profound. It might be opening to silence, to stillness. It might be resting the mind in luminous clarity. We might at times have glimpses of something profoundly peaceful. And without thinking about it, we say, ah, And our effort is not the effort of trying to accomplish something. And it's not the effort of letting go of something. And yet there is a direction to our effort. There is an inclination of the mind that rests in a profound state of peace. So the question of effort isn't just a matter of trying harder until sweat runs from our armpits, as the Buddha practiced prior to his enlightenment. And non-effort is not just a matter of hanging out and going with the flow of conditioned tendencies. Skillful effort requires an appropriate response to the conditions right now. So there are some practical things to consider as you play with effort in your practice. The first is to ask yourself if the amount of effort is correct, or are you applying too much force, or are you too lax? Not enough effort. How much effort does it take to stay present? The image that the Buddha used was of tuning a stringed instrument. If you tune the instrument too tight, it will make a bad sound. And if it's too loose, it's not going to make a good sound either. We have to have just the right tautness, tightness of the string on the instrument in order to make a proper sound. Similarly, in the meditation practice, we attune our effort to the moment at hand. This teaching on tuning the string instrument was given to one Venerable Sona, who was a very diligent young monk, and he was really putting forth the effort. He was really trying. In fact, he was doing walking meditation back and forth so diligently that the soles of his feet were cracked and bleeding. And because of this pain and this over-efforting, he started to get discouraged, thinking, I'm putting forth this effort, and I'm not making the accomplishment. I'm not succeeding. I think I'm going to give up. Just go back to the home life. My family has wealth. I can make some merit giving food to the other monks. It just isn't working for me. And he was overcome by discouragement. And that's the moment when the Buddha appeared and gave him this teaching of how of balancing our balancing the effort like tuning a stringed instrument. We can also consider if the quality of our effort is appropriate. Sometimes we might need very coarse effort, and sometimes it might be very subtle. Sometimes we can be flexible, responsive, and spacious, and other times we have to be determined and resolute and strong. How much effort is it needed to feel this breath right now? It may be a different quality of effort that will be needed to feel a breath tomorrow morning or at 11 o'clock tonight. Depending on the effort, depending on the energy that's available, depending on the external conditions, the depth of concentration or mindfulness, the momentum that we've been building throughout the day, a different quality of effort will be needed. And so the art of meditation practice is very much an art of effort. What is the appropriate quality and quantity of effort? What is the effort and what is the ease to bring clarity and mindfulness into this moment? We have to be willing to adjust our effort, not decide, I give this kind of effort all the time. We have to be willing to adjust it to the moment at hand. And we can practice observing our quality of effort not only when we're sitting in meditation practice, but how rigorously do you brush your teeth? Notice before you go to bed. Is it so weak that you barely get the stuff off your teeth?
Or is it so rigorous that you're trying to get that enamel off? How tightly do you turn a cap on a bottle? Does it just seal? Is it so loose that the ants can still find their way in? Or is it so tight that only you can get it open? What about when you meditate? What's your face doing? Are you scrunched up and serious, meditating with your facial muscles? Maybe there's excess muscular effort going on, and we might find that we can relax a lot of the body. And that can free up more effort, more energy for the meditation practice. Sometimes when I teach a concentration meditation and we focus just on the breath at the nostrils for long periods of time, people sometimes report that they get headaches because they're looking at this point. Well, you don't need the eyes to feel the breath. You don't need the eyes to know the breath. And if we stare with our eyes closed at our nostrils, we're making way too much effort. And so we can just relax the muscles and yet let the attention rest upon the breath. One of the Vipassana teachers in the States, Sharon Salzberg, often uses the example of broccoli. She says, okay, you've got the broccoli on your plate and you've got the fork in your hand. And you want to get the broccoli on the fork and in your mouth. Too much effort, bang! And you stab it and the plate shatters and the broccoli goes flying and it breaks apart and you don't get the broccoli. Too little effort. And it kind of sort of might get on your fork, but it'll fall off before you get it to your mouth. You have to know the right amount of effort. And the amount of effort for broccoli will be different depending on whether it's raw or whether it's cooked or whether it's mushy. Just as the different dishes that you take will require a different amount of effort. We naturally learn how much effort it takes to put a cucumber on a fork. And how much effort it takes to put take a lentil or some scoop of rice or something. Different. We have to be just as natural in the effort that we apply to our bodies and our minds, just as we would with a plate of food. We adjust our effort. Sometimes when I teach, I emphasize a lot of relaxation because sometimes I think, oh, people strive so hard. You know, just chill a little bit, relax a little bit, unwind, trust the experience. But sometimes I see the other side of it and I teach very strong effort. 100%. Oh, no, 120%. Practice day, practice night. Don't give up. Just push yourself. When you get tired, do standing meditation. I go back and forth. I go back and forth in my teaching. I go back and forth in my own practice. It's part of this continuous adjustment. It's like a continuous inquiry. Where is the balance? The balance is not a static point that is balanced. The balance is being willing to slide to this side and then slide to that side and slide back and forth without being disturbed. Equilibrium and equanimity is not a stable state. It's a responsive state. Sometimes more, sometimes less, sometimes right, sometimes left. But generally, I value a consistent perseverance. What is needed to be in this for the long run,
to bring a steady vigilance to our experience, a continuity of mindfulness throughout the day. To me, this is far more useful than short, intense bursts of effort. And so for this reason, I generally don't encourage people to just sit really strong, really long, you know, with a vow of stillness, but to instead trust that if we become attuned to our own needs, to the effort and to the energy that is available, then we will extend ourselves gradually using the fullness of our effort without tiring. We each will have our tendencies. Some of us will strive very hard and be very forceful in our effort, and others of us will be kind of lazy at heart. Sometimes we'll really be lazy at heart, and we know that, and so on the outside we'll try to look like we're striving. I encourage you to let go of all your views of yourself and just tune into the experience. How much effort is needed to be fully awake right now, present with what is, present with tiredness, present with the sensations of sitting. The Buddha taught four kinds of effort. He said we need the effort to avoid unwholesome states that have not yet arisen, the effort to abandon wholesome states if they have unwholesome states if they have already arisen, the effort to cultivate wholesome states that have not yet arisen, and the effort to maintain wholesome states that have already arisen. So the effort to avoid unwholesome states, for some examples of that would be to maintain the precepts and avoid harming others, to avoid the agitation of mind that comes, the fear that comes from stealing, the fear that comes from harming, to avoid intoxication that dulls the mind. The Buddha specifically suggested avoiding debt, avoiding dangerous cliffs, and avoiding sewers. There are good reasons to avoid certain dangers. Now, when we abandon unwholesome states that have already arisen, we're usually working with some form of greed, hate, or delusion. We're willing to let the hindrances go. We're willing to let anger go. We're willing to let resentment go. We're willing to abandon states that we know are only going to cause suffering. What do we cultivate? We cultivate wholesome states that have not yet arisen. We might be cultivating mindfulness, concentration, compassion, patience, generosity, loving kindness, wisdom. And when these states have arisen, they still need effort. We put forth the effort to maintain them. Just because mindfulness has arisen for one moment doesn't mean that it's going to last if we don't nurture it. Just because concentration, the mind has gotten concentrated in one sitting, if we don't nurture that and cultivate it, protect it, then it too will fade. So we maintain wholesome states. We give them our effort and our energy, but it's a much gentler form of effort than the effort to abandon a hindrance. Wise effort is a simple development towards what is fruitful and away from what brings suffering. To sustain a committed practice, you are going to need to employ all these efforts. Sometimes you will avoid, sometimes you will abandon, sometimes you will cultivate, and sometimes you will maintain. From time to time, we apply a range of skillful means as we develop this art of meditation. Let's have a few quiet minutes, please.